Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are fourth, yes, fourth, in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Saturday we left Carrow Road with a point after a somewhat lacklustre performance, but we remain unbeaten on the road and somehow we're still in the Champions League places. I'm still scratching my head about this. This is unbelievable, really. Speaking of champions, though, today we welcome Manchester City to the MX and they will be hungry for revenge after we beat them last season. Victory will put us third. And we are also in action on Wednesday night as we travel to Leicester, who will also be looking for revenge in the Carabao Cup. Also this week, fixture changes for December have been announced, which have left us with the prospect of an 8 p.m. kickoff on Boxing Day, which has left us colder than the turkey that we should have been eating at that time. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to welcome back Marcus Hancock. So now, Al, we've got Man City this weekend. What are your memories of playing against Man City?
Oh, there's so many. There's so many. Some positive, some not so positive. I mean, you know, we had the first ever Premier League game, which Peter James decides to set one of his Roy Grace books to. There was the penalty shootout, which is, and we were talking about this earlier, about how Manchester City's history started with a penalty shootout defeat at Withdean. There's also a time back in 1983 on the cup run. I have a scar across the bridge of my nose, which in those days when I didn't wear glasses because I was blind as a bat and vain as a peacock at the age of 13. It was during the warm-up. I turned round and put my nose up against the fence, those ridiculous perimeter fences that they had at the Goldstone. And without being able to see a thing, the ball went smack straight into the fence and the horizontal bar dug into my nose and there was claret everywhere. And I still have that scar. But we won the day 4-0 and went on to the cup final. Great memories of playing. And of course, then there was the game at the end of last season. Superb. Yeah. Marcus, have you got any?
Yeah, I've got one where I would have been a young sort of 16-year-old lad at the Goldstone, late 80s. Man City were going for promotion. In fact, I think they were sort of running for the title at that point. We were still sort of at the bottom end of the division, trying to stay up in the old Division 2, old money. And there was a game against Man City at home. And there was two good headers there. One was an own goal by Man City, which eventually proved to be the winner. And there was another header there where a guy on the touchline decided to backheader it into the crowd.
A bloke on the touchline?
You mean a ball boy?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the world's oldest ball boy. I think he was 41 at the time. it'd be good to get his side of events anyway.
Yeah, that was a guy called Keith Cuss. I mean, I wonder what he's doing now.
Well, let's put it like this. What was the 1st of April, 1989? Was it April Fool's Day, was it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Probably was.
Yeah, could have been good, yeah. Well, what I can remember by it was we were 2-1 up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was about the 89th minute, something like that. And we needed to win to stop being relegated. There was about 6 points, I think, we needed. Man City, I think, if I remember, it was Manchester City and Chelsea were pushing for promotion.
Yep.
Well, this is Division 2, by the way.
Yeah, Division 2. That, if you can remember, if you can think about Manchester City and Chelsea now compared with in 1989, it seems a bit farcical, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I know I can remember the ball coming towards me. It was they weren't doing very well. They're passing. They were panicking a bit, if I remember rightly. And their passing was not particularly good. And one of these stray passes, it was about the north stand side of the halfway line, by the end of the west stand.
Yeah.
And then the ball came towards me, and I was sort of in a crouching position. And I don't know quite what happened, but all I can remember is I lifted, as the ball came towards me, I lifted my head and it flipped and it went, sorry, I'm going to turn it off.
Did it make that noise as well?
Yeah, it flipped it flipped and went over. I can't remember when it got out of the ground, but it definitely went in behind the supporters in that terrace there.
It was the northwest corner, and it went into the car park.
Yes, where the old Lego stand used to be. There were some toilets there, weren't there? Yeah, that's right.
Was the do you recall if the Lego stand was still there?
No, it wasn't there then.
It was just the terracing.
It was just the terrace.
And then it went over to the back, and of course, it was a few seconds, not a great amount of time, but enough really to put them off their stroke, I suppose. And then it came on and it was thrown back into the game, and then more or less straight away it was the end of the 90 minutes. So, and then the players came off, and a few of the Brighton players came over to me and laughed and sort of had a joke about it. And then I, as we were all going down the tunnel, I had a couple of Manchester City players come up to me and said, "What did you do that for?" And I didn't answer them because I didn't want to get into any sort of confrontation, to be quite honest. So we all went down the tunnel, and that was the end of it, really. And the players took me out for a meal. we had a couple of drinks and things like that. And that was it until the Wednesday. The Wednesday, that was the 5th, and it was a reserve game. I went in as normal, you know, to sort out, because I still did. I did all the games, the first team games and the reserve games. And at that moment of time, I was working in Chessington. So I used to have to, and in reserve games, I used to come back all the way from Chessington to the Goldstone. I didn't get paid. I just did it, you know, for the love of it, really. Mm. Okay. Stephen Rook called me into his office and said, "I'm afraid we were disposing with, we don't want you anymore." I said, "Oh, well, that's very nice." and he said, "Well, you know, I'm sorry. You know, we're basically sacking you." I said, "Well, you can't sack me because you don't pay me. So, you know, you can ask me to leave. But you can't sack me anyway." So I took all my kit away and everything, because I supplied all the wet weather gear for the ball boys and everything. So I left it there. So I thought, well, I'm not going to be petty minded like they are. And that was the end of it. And I never went back after that. I don't know if you remember Gordon Lucking.
Yeah,
keep on trucking with GR Lucking. It was the sponsor on the back of the wet weather gear. I should put in this caveat: I used to be a ball boy with Keith back in the day, and I remember that those Adidas wet weather gear very, very, very well. And they keep on trucking with GR Lucking. We're not looking for a new sponsor.
Well, Gordon Lucking wanted to put money into the football club and become a director, but for some reason, they didn't want him in there because Gordon, you know, he was. I went to school with him, and he was in a class below me, so I knew him for years. And he was a very forthright man. He said what he felt, and I think that's what they didn't want. And the thing is, because it was so tight knit there, you know, but I don't think they wanted him in there. So he actually went to Crystal Palace and became a director there.
Oh,
but he was prepared to, he was prepared to put money into the club.
But that is petty minded.
Yeah, it is. But he went there, and actually they got into the cup final, and I went to the cup final with him actually to Crystal Palace, but to Wembley. But the problem was that there was such toxic, I suppose you could say. There was, I think, Stephen Rook, wasn't he part of Worthing? Was he a secretary at Worthing or something? But anyway, Barry Lloyd and that, they're all very close-knit, and it was very uncomfortable. But when I left, I just left Okay, I did something wrong. I admitted it. Like they always say, you get everybody gets their 15 minutes.
But yours comes 32 years later.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
It was on the front yeah. page of Goal's Eye, weren't you, as well? So,
yeah. Well, yeah. And I remember I moved down to Southampton and for some reason, TVS wanted to speak to me. And I remember doing an interview up the avenue, and they said, well, would you juggle a football? And then we'll have a little chat. I said, well, it's very difficult to juggle. And I went and felt the football when it was flat. And I said to him, this is like kicking a pudding. So I had a couple of tries at it, and it just went poom, poom, and that was the end of it, really. But I just did an interview. And I had a couple of newspapers come up to Chessington to interview me.
Wow.
I didn't do it for any reason. It's like anything, really. Something happens and you just do it.
Mm.
And that's one of the things. But it was just, I think Mel Machin complained about it. And then Peter Swales, who was a chairman at Man City at that time, kicked it all off, I think.
They blamed you for them losing. I mean, the fact it was in the 89th minute and they had a whole 89 minutes before that to do something about it was
they weren't playing that.
Yeah, they won't. They weren't. Was it Morley scored one of their goals? Was it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. And the other one was an own goal by
Ian Brightwell.
Yeah, Ian Brightwell. And they weren't playing that. You know, let's put it like the Goldstone, the surface wasn't that great at that time, really, was it, really? Because there's another thing I used to do at half time. I used to go around and put the divots back in. All the kids used to go and have a drink, and I used to go back out and.
I thought they did that in polo.
No. Some of that ground dug up really badly. There was another thing. Do you remember that the groundsman, they got, what was his name? Greg Stanley's driver became the, I can't remember his name, his chauffeur or his handyman became the groundsman there.
Instead of Frankie Howard?
Yeah, they got rid of Frankie and then they put this chap, don't you remember? I don't remember.
If you sold his name, we'd think, oh yeah, but I probably wouldn't have realised it was...
It was his handyman and come chauffeur. And Greg Stanley put him in as... He knew as much about gardening as I knew about rockets.
But Keith Duff Rockets is surely doing brilliantly at the moment, isn't it? Okay.
And the problem was, you know, the ground got worse and worse and worse. The only bit of grass was on the corner flags, I think.
I thought the only bit of grass was on the terraces.
Yeah, but it got really bad there. And you could see what was happening to the club. It was a shame, and I'm more or less positive it was being run down, so Greg Stanley could get hold of the freehold and put his do-it-all place. And that's what happened in the end, wasn't it?
So I was about to say. So all the while you were there, now admittedly you were let go in 1989, and the stuff that really happened really kicked on a few years later. But I mean, obviously that. If you have very little to do with the club during that time or in the intervening years, you're kind of watching the battles for the future of the club from a distance, from a neutral standpoint. But when you were at the club at the time, could you see the shoots of dissent or problems? Or let's put it this way, the way that the club went, was it a surprise to you?
No, not really. No, because there were some nice people. Ron Pavey, he was a lovely chap, and I knew him when he was in. He used to run the Sunday League, and on a reserve game after the game, I used to help him in the bar in the executive club serve the drinks and things like that. So I did little bits and pieces around. I enjoyed doing it, but there was just when on the reserve games, there was a certain amount of people that came in that weren't members of the executive club. And they were hangers on of Barry Lloyd and Greg Stanley. It was like a drinking club. And I just felt it was being used as a toy at that time, really, to run it down. And then obviously they went to Gillingham, and poor young supporters had to go up and down by bus. And then they went to With Dean, and I actually went to With Dean because my son was a mascot, because I still kept in touch with Dean Wilkins. I knew Mickey Adams as well from Southampton. We were friends. So, but it was just, I just felt it was going down and down and down. And you could see eventually something was going to happen. Of course, I wasn't there then. I moved to the New Forest and got involved. Well, not got involved, but I knew people at Portsmouth and Southampton, fortunately. And I became friends with Chris Nicol, Terry Fenwick. Sure. I got friendly with them. And I didn't work at the club of that, but I just was involved with the players and things like that, which was very nice after moving down, because I knew the only person I knew down here was Jimmy Case.
But with all that was going on, Keith, but all that was going on, I mean, you know, you could see it starting there. And bearing in mind what a generous man Mike Bamba had been. Now, you know, he was in charge of the club for a dozen or so years, and we had our, at the time, most successful period. But even then, you know, he was, when he was looking to retire and wind down, and maybe the vultures were circling. Now, we mentioned this chat before we started recording, but would you say that the problem started with the death of Keith Wickenden?
I would think so, because he was a genuine chap. I knew him slightly, not that well, but you could, I don't know, they just didn't, there wasn't the money being pumped into the club, let's put it like that, because no disrespect to a lot of the directors, they didn't have the money. It's one of these things these days. And then you needed somebody, a benefactor, to put money into a club. I don't think any football club made money then. But
if now.
Well, even now you don't. You know, a lot of these clubs are all hopped up to the eyebrows. Mm. But if you think about then, if you had to put a lot of money in, okay, the players weren't on a lot of money. The wages, I never, you know, we never spoke much about wages to friends of mine who played there. But you still need a lot of money for running the club. And I just felt when Greg Stanley took over, because he had a box at Chelsea, and he spent more time watching Chelsea than he did Brighton. And I just felt, why would you be involved with a club that, you know, you're not really 100% focused on? And I think that is the sad thing. Mike Bamba was a nice bloke. I knew him slightly, not that well, because I wasn't involved then that much. He did a lot for the club, an awful lot. And then after he left, there was like a tug of war, I think, you know, who was going to take over. A lot of the directors, I say, didn't like me. I'm not saying didn't like me, but they were frightened of what I knew, you know, if all the little things that went on. And I've never spoken much about it, and I won't say certain things about it, but it was just uncomfortable, really. The players and that were happy. Everything, you know, the backroom staff were happy. Mike Yaxley, Jock, and that all seemed very happy. And Barry Lloyd, you know, I never had a cross word with him, but I just felt it wasn't the right person, really. And Greg Stanley obviously put him there. And then Chris Catlin, I bet he was miffed because he got the sack, and that was another nice chap. You know, a lot of people didn't like him, but I felt he was a really nice chap and a gentleman. But a lot of the directors, I find it a bit strange, that's all. When I left, I look and listen to the thing. I listen to Warren Aspinall because I've known Warren for a long time.
Can you understand him?
Yeah, well, I used to go out drinking with him, so I know.
Oh, yes.
That's a good starting point.
Warren and I went out a few times to Simon's Wine Bar, and I've known it. He went through a really bad time, and he's got a friend of mine. But Warren, I've always liked. He's a bit of a hard man. He was a hard footballer, but a nice person.
He really is. We've got to know him a little bit over the years.
And I haven't spoken to him lately because I actually haven't been to the new ground, to to be quite honest, because I wasn't sure whether I'd be welcome there or not. So I
Can I put this to you, Keith?
Yeah.
If you are not sure as to whether the club, the hierarchy, would welcome you, yeah, there will be thousands of fans of a given age who, for, if nothing else but for the story that we start told at the top of the show this week, would happily have you along as their guest. Even if it's sitting in amongst the seats, in amongst the, as the club used to call us, the ruffians. Yeah. You know, I'd be delighted to if I could, you know, had a spare seat next to me, I'd be delighted to have you along as my guest. So if it's not the club, then there will be no end of fans who remember that particular episode against Man City who would happily have you along. So with that in mind, Keith, would you take their invitation up?
Oh yeah, yeah. My brother goes every week. He's got a season ticket. You know, I would definitely go. I've got a soft spot still for Brighton. Although, you know, it was a difficult thing at that moment in time. But and I moved on a bit. When I moved down here, I believe it or not, at 41, I still played football. And when I moved down to Southampton, I got friendly with a few chaps at an Italian restaurant, and they asked me to play for their side on a Sunday. So I paid for their son. And towards the end of the season, I can remember this, near Southampton Airport, there's a sports field there, and we were playing. I was playing centre back, and this young lad was running down the wing, and I went to tackle him, and unfortunately, being a bit, I was 45 at the time, I was a bit slow in the tackle. So, obviously, I caught him a bit, and the referee gave a foul. And he came up to me, and this is a true story, he put his hands on my shoulders and said, "I can honestly go back to my wife and say, I refereed a game where a chap was older than me." And when he said to me, "I think you're getting on a bit," I thought, "Well, that's a lot. That's the last game I ever played, I think."
So you bowed out with no level of dignity whatsoever. Yeah, but
I didn't beat Stanley Matthews. Unfortunately.
Okay, Keith. I mean, it would be remiss of us not to go back over some of the other things. I mean, obviously, you're famous for being the oldest ball boy in town. But I mean, you were at the club for a long time before that, and you did all sorts of other jobs behind the scenes. You ran the players' bar, etc. And you had a very, very good relationship with the players. In fact, you're actually Kevin Bremner's kit sponsor as well, weren't you?
Yeah, I remember Kevin. Yeah, he was a nice chap. Yeah, because a lot of them used to live in Worthing. Alan Kirbishley and Danny Wilson. There's so many of them.
Gary Nelson moved over here.
Gary Nelson. Yeah, I remember sleeping in his garage actually.
Go on, tell us that story then, Keith.
No, that was after the PFA in London in Park Lane.
You realise that in telling these stories, how much you're dissing the reputation of all these various footballers as well. Yes, yeah, so there I was at the PFA rep, and I ended up sleeping in Gary Nelson's garage when .. And the story always finishes.
We all went up to the PFA in a minivan. We went up there and obviously sort of you have a table. And, I can remember Mo's having a few drinks.
No.
And afterwards, when we went back, it was sort of early hours of the morning. And of course, I couldn't drive all the way back from Southampton then. So he said, "Well, you can keep in the garage if you like." So I did. So I kept in the garage. We had I think it was a put me up or something like that. But he was a lovely bloke too, Gary Nelson.
Keith, I'm going to put this to you. If you remember it, it didn't happen.
Yeah. No, I can remember that.
Oh,
no.
Good. Yeah.
No, I can remember it. No, it's old things, lots of different things. You know, when we used to go out after a game on a Wednesday, on a Saturday, because all the wives used to come on a Saturday to the games, and on a Wednesday night all the players used to go down to the cricketers mostly for a drink and to have a chat.
Hang on, Keith, which one, the Brighton one or the Hove one?
The Hove one.
Okay.
By the cricket ground.
Yeah,
because we all went down there one night, and there was, I'll tell you what, it was Joe Corrigan, Danny Wilson, and a few of the others. We were just having a drink.
Of course.
And that's when we were sponsored by British Caledonian.
Yeah.
And then they used to invite air hostesses down.
Oh, bloody hell.
There was no funny business.
Anyway, these air hostesses were down there and they were walking around talking to the players and asking them who they were and, you know, what they did and everything. And they were all chatting, you know, we're just all talking. And then one came round to me and said, what do you do? I said, well, nothing. I'm just a ball boy. All right, thank you very much. And off she went. If it was a footballer, she would have kept talking to me. But I wasn't important enough, so.
Well, you could have sold her as being a footballer who was just too old.
No, I wouldn't do that. No. So, you know, there were lots of nice things that we used to go to, you know, meals and things like that. The players really got on well together. They were a good bunch.
I'm going to be honest with you. We've had the likes of Danny Wilson and John Keeley, and we've had many players on from the 80s, and they can all tell you exactly the same stuff. Catlin and Rollings and even Mark Lawrenson, and bearing in mind how stratospheric his career went, they'll all tell you about what a great time they had playing for Brighton and Hove Albion. I mean, you mentioned Danny Wilson. He was one of my favourite players of the 80s. And in fact, I have now a very rare red Phoenix Brewery shirt that they wore at Peterborough. I've got his. Obviously, it's about 14 sizes too small for me, but it is actually my treasured thing. But when they joined, and I think that the mainstay of it was Steve Foster.
Steve was nice too. It was because they went when, do you remember, they went to Luton?
Mm-hmm.
Steve and Danny went to Luton.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went up to watch them one day. Anyway, Dan went up with Danny and his wife Karen, really nice people, and stayed after the game. And they said they actually put me up for the night and said, you can stay with us. Nice people. There were, you know, there was some genuine people. I don't think there was. There's one person I still keep in touch with really close, and that's Graham Pearce.
Oh, really? How is he?
Oh, wow.
He's fine. He's a teacher.
At Leeds?
Yeah, he lives in Brentford. I keep in touch with him.
Fantastic.
Joe Corrigan, I get the odd mesh, give the odd message to him, and we sort of have the odd text to one another. Yeah. I haven't got the other numbers, but everybody's moved on, so... Dean Wilkins, I used to sort of deal with him, but he obviously, he came to Southampton.
Yep.
With Atkins, and so we got sort of got together again and had a chat. We used to see one another, and he popped round to my house a couple of times. Jimmy Case, I see Jimmy now and again.
Is he still down Southampton way?
Yeah, he lives in Chandler's Ford. No, I spoke to him yesterday, actually. He was fishing. Cool. He was actually fishing. But he's very busy because he goes backwards and forwards to Liverpool because he's sort of like in the executive club. He goes there and he speaks to people and they sign things and things like that.
Sure.
He's very busy. A lot of the other ones have sort of disappeared, really.
One of those, when we were talking about this before we came on air, and it links in with that shirt you were talking about earlier, Al, and there was a player that came to us in 1985 called Justin Fashanu, and you got on very well then.
Justin Fashanu, whatever people think, he was a gentleman, one of the first players to come out. But he was the only one. Yeah, but he was really nice, would always have a long conversation with you. He used to have a little chat. And I remember at the end of his career, when he went over to America to have an operation on his knees to try and continue playing football, and then he came back, and he was sitting in the players' lounge in his suit, and we were having a chat and everything. And I said, well, what do you have done? Anyway, he pulled his trouser leg up and showed me his knees, and he actually had gold injected into his knees because they said it might improve it. And they were like saucers. They looked so blown up, so uncomfortable. And he never played after that. So, you know, whatever, it was a silly thing to do, really. But, and then unfortunately, we heard about his death, which was a sad thing. You know, I felt really sad because, you know, I didn't know him as a friend, but I knew him, you know, we used to have conversations in the players' lounge after the games. Like most of the players, we used to sit there sometimes and have a little chat and talk. But I just felt sad, really.
Sure.
You know, and I think his brother, you know, I don't know if his brother ever talks about it, but why he ever did it, I don't know. You know, obviously, I suppose, if you finish your career and you feel you're not going to go anywhere and you've suddenly been stigmatized with what he was, it was disgraceful. It still is disgraceful. And John must have felt really terrible then.
In fact, on last week's show, we had Di Cunningham from Proud Canaries, and their symbol of protest, almost their symbol of continuation, is Justin himself. Obviously, he was a big fella at Norwich as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, that he is their kind of their icon, and the fact that he played here, and yeah, I mean, we've spoken many times on this show about how society has moved on and how things have moved on. I just want to actually end this little bit before we go to Shirt of the Week. I just want to end with this little caveat, and it's a very personal thing to me, so bear with me, but it does link back to what we were talking about. Last week or a couple of weeks ago, I took my 10-year-old niece, Sienna, to the Brighton versus Tottenham women's game up at Crawley. And when we're guests of the club, the club were very good to invite us up there. As guests, and it was lovely, and we beat Spurs 2-1, and it was great. Now my niece, I think, you know, as a 10-year-old, now the education is getting through to her, and it's something I'm very proud of that she's done. She had previously been wearing a kind of a rainbow mask, you know, the breathing mask, but it was all the pride colours. And she said to me, "Why don't they come up with the thing of, you know, when it's Pride Month, instead of the numbers, have them as rainbow colours instead?" I thought, well, it's brilliant. I had seen that the club had done it just as a one-off shirt. But I said, well, in that case, tell, and here's Polly Bancroft, the general manager of women's team. I said, you know, I've had her on before, talk to that. And the club were really taken with that. Now, as it transpires also, the fact that my niece has also got 100% win record for watching the Albion, so we've got to take her as often as possible. But it just occurred to me, and this is where I think society moves on here, Keith, Marcus, AD, that when we go from Justin Fashanu and the grief that he had to put up with 35 years ago versus now, where my 10-year-old niece can say, "I think we should have more pride colours on the Albion shirt." I like that. So we haven't had you on much yet, Marcus, but
I've been just enjoying Keith's stories, quite frankly. It's, brilliant.
Okay, we'll hear more of them after this. But first, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As usual, we're delighted to be brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and we have got a shirt of the week for you. Marcus, can you have a look at this and describe it for me?
Yeah, well, it's basically a shirt which is probably designed from about the sort of mid-90s, because it's got the sort of upside down sort of, I'm going to say upside sort of pointing down triangle, pointing up triangle. It's blue
zigzaggy.
And white. Zigzaggy. Yes, that's a good word. Yes, zigzaggy. I'm definitely going to put this at mid-90s, but I could be wrong.
Just because it's revolting.
Yes, it is certainly not one of Phil's vintage shirts, let's put it that way. So it's got sort of the white zigzags, I guess, with being the sort of like white triangles on a blue background. There's a bit of yellow in there, sponsored by Buchanan's Toffees. You can't really read the sponsor. It's got a collar, and you know I'm a big lover of shirts with collars on, so that's a win. It's all right, I guess, but not a vintage one by any stretch of the imagination.
Any guess who it might be?
I'm guessing it's some sort of Scottish team, but that's about as far as it goes. Probably like a division, probably Inverness, yeah. Caledonians, Thistles, Old you, Shirt.
You've been reading Phil's post this week, haven't you, Marcus?
All right. Well, he was following me around Scotland because I was right, just there the week before.
Of course it's Scottish. Of course it's Scottish. Where's he been all week? And this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. I asked him for a shirt. Well, as it happens, I've just come down from the Isle of Skye after a week and a bit on holiday in the Northern Territories. We went ground hopping to the Caledonian Stadium to watch Inverness Caledonian Thistle play Greenock Morton in a championship match last Saturday. It felt a bit weird supporting a side in blue and red stripes, but Cali won 2-0 and I bought a white and grey away shirt in the club shop, which I dare say we will see at some point over the next year or so. So here was your shirt of the week. You're correct, Marcus. It is mid-90s or early 90s, actually. This is the 1991-93 home shirt of Greenock Morton. For those of us of a certain age, Morton. Nicknamed the Ton. Greenock Morton play in the Scottish Championship. Their home games are at the 11,589 capacity Capello Stadium in Greenock, which is just to the west of Glasgow. The side was formed in 1874 and has spent most of their history outside of the top flight of Scottish football. Probably their most illustrious player historically was the great Sir Stanley Matthews. He made several appearances for the Morton during World War II while serving in the RAF. Another former player of note is Joe Jordan, who began his career with the Ton in 1968. Albion links include Mark McGee, who made 64 appearances for Morton at the start of his career. For the youngers in the audience today, he also managed Brighton between 2003 and 2006. Thanks for that, Phil. And for the old ones, in the 1962-63 season, centre forward Joe Cavan played for the Albion 10 times before returning north of the border. He made 41 appearances for Morton between 63 and 65. Slightly more up to date, defender Ben Sampaio played a handful of cup games for the Albion in 2012-2013 season before moving on. He was with Morton for the 2014-2015 season. So thanks for that, Phil. And of course, you can see that and over 110,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com.
He is actually nudging 120,000, actually. So, and obviously, it always grows exponentially. Well, not exponentially, it grows very much at the beginning of each season. So if you do have a football shirt out there, a genuine one, not a Toffs replica, and you fancy putting it up on the world's largest online gallery, then just go to oldfootballshirts.com, click upload a picture, and just make sure that it's not been there before, and you will be part of, an absolute tidal wave of football shirts.
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember that Phil's been in Scotland for a week and a half. So, I mean, that 119,000, whatever it is, will probably be 122 by the time he's validated all his own shirts from his trip.
What's he going to go down into? I mean, the Highland League, Highland League 2, which is basically one man and his haggis watching it.
Hey, don't knock one man and his haggis. I like a haggis.
Okay.
Okay, so we're here with Marcus Hancock and the famous Keith Cuss, him with the backward header at the Goldstone in 1989. Keith, obviously you're at the club for a very long time, but when did your alliances start with the club?
Oh, I think when I was about 10. I can remember the Goldstone where the West Stand is, there was like a green pavilion, and then he used to have fold-up chairs out the front. I remember one game, I can't remember, it was such a big crowd that a lot of the children sat round on the, do you remember it had a sort of a red grit? Round.
Was this against Watford and Adrian Thorne scored a hat-trick? Four goals?
No, we got five.
It was so crowded that they sat round the cinder track. Yeah. I can remember that. And then at the end, everybody got up and then dusted themselves off. And it was like this big red cloud that went across the ground.
I don't know if it was that game. There was some absolutely brilliant footage that exists of, I think it was on one of a Dick Knight DVD or something from.
It was on Pathé News, wasn't it?
I think it was, but there was this brilliant thing where Adrian Thorne scored a goal, and it was being very rarely in those days. It was actually being filmed, and just as he kicked the ball, a policeman walked past the camera and blocked the whole view of the whole thing, which is not quite as good as one of the goals that was scored in the week this week where. The penalty was taken and it hit the steward squarely in the face.
The one thing I'd say about that game, obviously, it's a famous game, is that Adrian Thorne's hat trick was actually scored in the first 5 minutes. I mean, it was that mad. And it was obviously Albion's first ever promotion. Or certainly, after we joined the Football League, it was the first ever promotion. But okay, so Keith, you started in the late 50s watching the Albion, but. You know, it was probably tough times through the 60s. You saw the team go up to the second division and not really crack it and then sort of just do a little bit of a crash in the early 60s into the fourth division. So, I mean, one of the main headlines from those days was the acquisition of Bobby Smith. Does that register with you at all?
I remember Bobby Smith. He came down from Tottenham. There was a rumour that he came down and Brighton paid it.
Gambling debts.
Yeah. Whether it's true or not, we never know. But, you know, it's then when he came down, there was this thing went round. It's Brighton is for the retirement home for footballers or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
So now it's time in that case, because we do have to move on talking about other stuff. And obviously, please do stick around. But in all that time, from the late 50s through to, I guess, probably your late 80s when they stuck to, I mean, just being told off by Stephen Rook must be like being ravaged by a dead sheep. So you've got this kind of 32 year window of supporting Albion. So out of that, we always ask this with people who come on the show first time, who is your favourite player and who do you think was the best player? And they're not always one and the same.
I still think Jimmy Case was one of the best players. Danny Wilson was a really good midfield player as well. It seems to be the midfield players that used to stand out.
Yeah.
At Brighton, Danny Wilson was what I call a busy player. He was always involved, and Jimmy Case was the same. I think that sort of sticks in my mind a bit, you know. But the trouble is, there's so many players there. Goalkeepers, it's like John Kilo. He was good. Joe Corrigan, Sausage Fingers, we used to call him.
Not his face.
I've still got a pair of gloves, you know. So
Joe Corrigan was a great goalkeeper. John Keeley was a great goalkeeper for us. Graham Moseley. I mean, we talk about
Perry Digweed. I mean, he was there all that time, wasn't he?
Alan Pownie. What about Alan Pownie?
Brian Pownie.
Yeah, well, yeah, Brian Pownie.
He went to school with my mum. Which is very nice.
Jeez. Who was the old one in the 60s and 70s? Eric Gill.
Eric Gill.
But Marcus, when we're talking about like favourite players, I mean, it's quite often it's strikers that stick out for Keith. It's obviously midfielders. But I mean, what when you're looking at when your favourite players stick out for you, what is it a specific position or is it just Glenn Murray?
Glenn Murray is no. I would say my last favourite player is Glenn Murray. Obviously, you know, I'm a big fan, and you know, not going to hear anything said against him. But you know, the best player. I mean, that's tricky, but I still think probably Vicente is the best player to put on a Brighton shirt in my time. I was just Lawrenson had just sort of disappeared by then because I know he's up there. I wasn't around for the sort of Danny Wilson era. So for me, the best player at the moment is still Vicente, but my most favourite player ever is Glenn Murray.
And we must point out that both Glenn Murray and Fern Whelan have been made club ambassadors this week. So therefore further cementing the legendary status.
We've just lost Keith by the looks of it. Okay, well, Marcus, there's been other news this week. I mean, the fixture list has changed massively, and on our private WhatsApp group, you made a very poignant post that we had off a game against Everton on the 28th of August, which is at Saturday at 3 o'clock. Our next home game on a Saturday at 3 o'clock is like well, next scheduled one is Crystal Palace in January, but we don't think that's going to be there either, do we?
Well, that's probably going to get moved, in all fairness, whether it gets moved for TV or whether it gets moved on police advice or something. So that's probably going to get shunted. It probably won't be a Saturday 3 o'clock. If anything, it'll be, you know, we've had midday kickoffs against Palace. It's been moved to, you know, a Monday evening. It's so I think that will be moved as well. So, you know, that means that we are now big time. Because as I say, you know, it's teams like Arsenal, Man United and, you know, Man City that look forward to a Saturday 3 o'clock, you know, because they don't get them that often. And now we're in that group. I guess that's, you know, reflective of our league position as it is at the moment. You know,
so we're now going to be playing sort of peak time Kuala Lumpur hour.
Yeah, basically, yeah. You know, the Indian fan zones are going to love it because, yeah. You know, but it's all about the international brand, isn't it? I mean, you know, without getting on a rant, but, you know, the Boxing Day game, which I know we're going to sort of talk about, the rearrange at sort of 8 o'clock. I mean, that's ridiculous, not just for Brighton fans, but also for Brentford fans.
Tell us then, mate. Tell us your thoughts on that.
Well, if I speak for myself, it doesn't really bother me that much because I live in walking distance from the Amex and, you know, there are going to be, you know, scratch buses, you know, hell, I could ride my bike there. I could walk. I could, you know, I could drive my car and sort of park fairly locally. So, you know, for me, it's not a problem. But for all these people who've sort of got not family arrangements on Boxing Day, because I know Boxing Day is a family day, but just, you know, 8 o'clock, no trains as it is at the moment. The club are going to have to lay on, you know, presumably special coaches like they did for the Arsenal game when we played them a few seasons ago. And then Southern Rail decided to put some trains on, which upset the club, and quite rightly so. But yeah, 8 o'clock in the evening, Brentford fans have got to get home. It's just a nonsense time. It should be, you know, 3-4 o'clock, fine. But 8 o'clock in the evening, it's just bonkers on Boxing Day. It's just madness.
Marcus, we were talking about this throughout lockdown, about the fact that, you know, there were certain kickoff times that once fans were allowed back into the stadium, we would hope we're going to disappear. The Saturday late kickoff was, it's rubbish for everyone. For who's going to be watching that game? It's a kickoff time which is not a traditional kickoff time for anybody. And, you know, and as you correctly said, I mean, for the away supporters, for the home supporters, with no public transport, for a ground that's designed to be got to by public transport, it's just an absolute joke. And I just, you know, there's going to be, I mean, we know what the pretendants will be, but it's like the actual people going on a Boxing Day where it's traditionally a family day. I mean, I don't know what the TV companies are thinking of with this, because no one's going to be watching it.
Well, I think, you know, I want to say in fairness to the TV companies, it's just no game should be kicking off at 8 o'clock on Boxing Day, no matter who it is. Even if the fixtures fell kindly for, let's say, Man City v Man United, you know, most of their fans come from outside of Manchester anyway, so they'll be just as inconvenienced. So, no, I mean, it shouldn't be, you know, 8 o'clock on Boxing Day is nonsense. You know, people should be home by then, as you said, AD, eating into their cold turkey. They shouldn't be getting home at 11, 12 o'clock at night. You know,
Marcus, I mean, I don't know if there is a precedence for this, but I mean, basically, the Liverpool were given a fixture on Christmas Eve.
That's right.
At 7 o'clock, I think, away at Arsenal a couple of years ago. Yeah. And they managed to get it moved. Is there a possibility that could happen?
No, can I jump in there? That I was, as part of the FSA thing and the nonsense that they had with that, they really kicked off a stink. And I think that, you know, it was such a stink that you could see the hairdryer effect on the Premier League, and they thought, you know, well, we're not going to do this again. If nothing else, because it actually had an indirect consequence on other fixtures, because I think it was something along the lines of, well, there was Christmas Eve and then there was Boxing Day. And I said, hang on a minute, this ain't working. So yeah. I think that was, yeah, you're home to conspiracy or cock-up. I think that was just a cock-up. I think your point about a precedence is one thing. I just don't think they're going to do it again. But your point about Boxing Day, the thing about Boxing Day trains is there's one train. It's always been one train an hour from London to Brighton. So that's a mainline thing. But yeah. Brighton East and Brighton West, there's no trains. They're considered local lines. So you've not got those trains. And that's where the buses kick in. Maybe it's a design flaw of the stadium that public transport is such an important thing, because it ruins us for a Boxing Day home game. 'Twas ever thus the first time that we had this problem in our second season, and it still hasn't been addressed totally. We've papered over the cracks and got away with it. But to then have it at 8 o'clock, words fail me.
Yeah, and me. Well, they like don't.
Say, if, yeah. All right, we don't. All right, if you'd like to think that your point about Liverpool, Man City, Man United, they're in the same city. Even London v London, you're in the same city. And I think there's certain aspects of London transport do operate on Boxing Day. We don't have that equivalent. The closest we could have or ever have is Brighton against Crawley. Well, we're not in the same division. But my point would ever be, one, we can't host anyone at home. But two, if you do, you know, Brentford is about as close as you could get. It's either that or it's Palace, but it's about as close as you could get. But even then, to move it, it's just, you know, like you say, they're not going to, if they can get home, and it's a massive if, we're talking a stadium size if, they can get home, they're not getting home till, you know, midnight. On Boxing Day, you know, don't get me wrong, we could have arguments about how well, you know, any given person gets on with their family, but that's another matter entirely.
Okay, well, just before we finish, we did have a game last weekend. Let's just briefly touch on that. It was 0-0 away at Norwich. There was a lot of chuntering and going, oh, we should be beating teams like Norwich, which is like, any Brighton fan worth their salt knew exactly that we would not win that game. Because Norwich, who haven't won all season, only picked up 1 point. That's exactly the game we would normally lose, and we could have quite easily lost it, Marcus.
Yeah, we could have done, actually. I mean, there was the Sanchez rush of blood and, you know, there was the, you know, and it's almost like the WTF moment. I listened to it on the radio before watching the highlight, because I generally do that. If I can't make the game, I listen to it on the wireless, because I just love listening to Aspinall and JC. Of course, that was highly amusing when Sanchez did this. And of course, you know, then there was Dan Burns, you know, Dan Burns wonder tackles, you know, sort of, you know, rolling back the years for sort of Mark Lawrence, who used to do that, stretch out
a leg. They really were wonder tackles, weren't they?
You know, and you know, and you know, good old Dan Byrne, because, you know, he got a bit of stick last season, but, you know, and even this season he didn't start, but he's come in and, you know, he's picked up from where he finished against Man City at home last year. And, you know, and we've got some injuries, you know, Webster, you know, my favourite player, Webster's out at the moment. you know, and Bassoon is sort of, you know, not featuring at the moment, shall we say. So, you know, he's had to shuffle the deck again. But you're right, AD. And we should have had a penalty, you know. And Jeff Stelling's waving his glasses about, saying, do you need these, referee? Yeah. You know. But you're right, AD. Ultimately, last season, that was probably a game he would have lost. So, you know. Take the draw and
bizarrely, it lifted us up 2 places to fourth.
Well, yeah, it did, didn't it? Because Man United lost, so we actually got off. Crazy.
My bet in the wild with that game was the miss by Neil Morpay at the end. I mean, the penalty, I think he could actually taken that first time and actually scored rather than going around the keeper. But that's another. That's if buts and pants.
International striker, are you?
But oh yeah, absolutely. But I mean, the miss at the end, that was one that he should have taken, Marcus.
Yeah, again, but you know, it's one of those things. At the moment, Maupay's got a lot of credit, so you know, if he keeps doing it like he did last season, then we got a problem. But at the moment, you know, he's you know, 8 games, 4 goals. You know, he's confidence at the moment. Hopefully, he should have had a penalty, so hopefully that won't knock him back too much. He did start off last season with a bit of a flurry and then sort of tailed off as the season progressed. But you know, Potter's already said it, that you know, he's you know, he's a different player now. He's sorted out. You know, he had some, you know, personal issues, as you know, some of the players do have, and he said he's now you know, firing on all cylinders. So. Yeah, mate, he should have done. He probably knows he should have done. And hopefully against Man City, he'll get a similar chance and tuck it away. And, you know, we go home happy.
Al, that chance was created by Solly March, who seems to become a little bit of a forgotten man.
Well, when you've got a team that's playing as well as they have been and getting the results in, then you, any given manager would be loath to shuffle things around. Obviously, Cucurella came in because he was bought to do the job. And he has easily justified his place. I don't think anyone could argue with that. And Solly March was always everyone had this notion, as well as he did at left back or left wing back, you knew that wasn't his natural position. You know that his position is much more of an advanced player. So sometimes when Potter would then shuffle the deck during a game, Molly Sarch would end up on the right-hand side, cutting in. But I think actually between them, there is a case to make a powerhouse of Cucurella and March between them. But you've also got to remember their similarities as well as their differences. But once again, we are indebted to the whole notion of the fact that the entire squad is so flexible that you can't just say that, yes, well, Cucurella is only, to be honest, they're probably there for one position, but Solly March has it within him to play in several positions. So the flexibility that you have doesn't necessarily mean you've got that it's a case of Cucurella v. March, because there is nothing wrong with playing the two. It's just they might not be playing on the same side.
I mean, I'd like to see Cucurella and March playing on together. I mean, if one bonds forward, the other one can drop in, and you're adding a little bit more solidity on that flank.
You know what? I mean, I'm sure it's something that probably Potter is working on in the training ground at the moment, because, you know, they could have that sort of, you know, Bruno and Knockart sort of, you know, understanding, you know, when we romp to the, you know, when we romp the champ, I say romp the championship, but, you know, when we got promoted. So, you know, that is a mouth-watering prospect, because we know Solly can defend. We know Cucurella can defend. We know they're great going forward. So, you know, if you can somehow get them both playing together on the same side of the pitch, then I think that'd be quite exciting.
I kind of feel they just get under each other's feet. If Cucurella was going to play, I'd rather have March on the other side.
No, it makes sense. I mean, if we, no one would complain at that, would they? To be fair, absolutely.
Well, another feature of the Norwich game was that we saw the first league action for Tarek Lamptey. So, if you want to see March on the other side, do we play Tarek Lamptey as well then now?
No, I'd still rather see Veltman at the moment, especially against Man City. I'd much rather see Veltman.
I think Veltman will be playing against Man City, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. We need the experience as well.
I think if we're really going to get Lamptey running again, then play him against Leicester.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's a prospect. I mean, Leicester will be looking for revenge. Man City will be looking for revenge. We'll be looking to move up to third in the table if we win this weekend. And hopefully that's what we'll be talking about next week on the Albion Roar, which you have been listening to on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. Online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show has been brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. I'd like to thank my guests, Alan Wares, Marcus Hancos, Keith Cuss. I've been Eddie Packham. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye. See you.